from the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV, LP, Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a conversation with Vermont author Micaiah Bay Gault, whose new novel is Goodnight Stranger, published by Park Row Books. Micaiah Bay Gault grew up on Sanibel Island, Cape Cod, and other beautiful places. A graduate of the Syracuse MFA program, she now teaches in the MFA in Writing and Publishing program at Vermont College of Fine Arts and is the coordinator of the Vermont Book Award. She's the recipient of a Vermont Arts Council Creation Grant and a fellowship at the Vermont Studio Center. She lives in Montpelier, Vermont, with her husband, three kids, and some backyard chickens. Here's a little information about Goodnight Stranger. Lydia and Lucas Moore are in their late 20s when a stranger enters their small world on Wolf Island. Lydia, the responsible sister, has cared for her pathologically shy brother Lucas ever since their mom's death a decade before. They live together, comfortable yet confined, in their family house by the sea, shadowed by events from their childhood. When Lydia sees the stranger step off the ferry, she feels an immediate connection to him. Lucas is convinced the man, Cole Anthony, is the reincarnation of their baby brother who died when they were young. Cole knows their mannerisms, their home, the topography of the island. What else could that mean? Though Lydia is doubtful, she can't deny she is drawn to his magnetism, his energy, and his warmth. To discover the truth about Cole, Lydia must finally face her anxiety about leaving the island and summon the strength to challenge Cole's grip on her family's past and her brother. I found the first line of the book to be a punch and a riddle. Baby B was our brother, and he'd been dead all our lives. That sentence drew me right in as I began to read. So when I spoke with Micaiah earlier this week, I asked her to talk about beginning the novel in that way. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
Yeah. Oh, I love that question because no one's asked me that. And I actually have strong feelings about that, the first line and sort of a story. So it took me 15 years to write this book. And my guess is that I probably went through, 70 or 80 drafts. I mean, I wrote and wrote and rewrote and rewrote the book. So that first line came in a pretty late draft. Okay. And I can't remember exactly. I was really struggling with the opening. I was struggling with the first chapter. I think I knew we were getting ready to send it out. So I wanted that first chapter to really work, and especially the first few lines.
Right.
And I was working, my colleague then at Vermont College of Fine Arts, where I was working, was Juliana Baggett, the novelist. And I was talking with her about it, and she somehow said to me, you should do that trick where you just sum up your entire book in one sentence in your first line. And I thought, oh, well, how could I do that with this? It's, it's a literary thriller. If there are a lot of mysteries, I can't sum it up or it would give too much away.
Right.
And then I thought, well, maybe I'm looking at it wrong. I don't need to give away any of the plot things, but what are the big emotions of the book? What is the big thing I'm trying to say? And I said, I'm going to try to sum up the entire book in the first couple of lines, the first two sentences, really. And that's what I came up with. And I loved it. It worked.
It totally
so
works.
I'm glad you liked it too, because I feel really proud of my first line.
Now I'm trying to remember your second line. For a long time I thought I'd see him again, but by the time I was 28, I believed that the dead stayed dead. So that's your second line. Together, they work really well to pull people in.
Yeah, and just to really, but don't they just sort of sum up the entire book?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Now let's see. I want to talk a little bit about your main character, Lydia. And Lydia and you have some similarities in that you both kind of, at least at some point in your life, you grew up on the Cape. So you are well-versed in island life, and so is Lydia. And she works for the ferry system, and she's a self-proclaimed expert on the people who arrive on the island by ferry. And I loved that. She can tell who's a tourist and who's a local, although she probably knows them anyway, and, you know, who's there for some sort of other reason. So that was a wonderful way to set her up as something of, as a good narrator, as a good observer, too.
Thank you. Yeah, well, I mean, and isn't that, you know, as writers, where we train ourselves to watch and make decisions about the world around us, right? That's, you know, so that idea that she is kind of watching everybody stepping off the boat and then categorizing them. I mean, I don't know that writer's job is to categorize, but there is a sort of, we are making sense of the world around us constantly, wouldn't you say? We are shuffling information around to make it work with our, if not worldview, aesthetic view.
Yeah. And I don't think that the fact that she can categorize people necessarily makes her a good narrator. But I do think the fact that she's observing people closely, I guess, is what I would say.
Yeah, that's right.
But then this stranger arrives and she has no idea where to put him in her, you know, in her system of knowledge. And that's really interesting, too.
Yeah. Do you know the famous quote that, it's a famous John Gardner quote.
Okay.
People refer to it all the time. Although then I couldn't actually find when he originally said it or wrote it. There's some confusion about that. But the people definitely quote him as saying it a lot. And it's that there are only two, original plot lines in fiction, and one is someone goes on a journey, and the other one is a stranger comes to town. And so I thought about that a lot writing it. I thought, I'm definitely writing the stranger comes to town plot line.
Pretty clearly.
Yeah.
Did you ever ask Doug Glover about that quote?
No, I didn't. Why? Is he like a big John Gardner?
I don't know that he's a big fan, but he knew him. He knew him, and they were acquainted, so he probably knows. But anyway, whatever. So
he might know, yeah. Some people thought that he had said it in a lecture at Breadloaf. That was one guess. So it had never been recorded anywhere, but people remembered it because they were at that lecture and then wrote about it from that point on.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah. All right, so the arrival in town of this stranger who calls himself Cole, he hits it off with Lydia and her brother Lucas, but for very different reasons. And there's just right away, there's a lot of intrigue around this person who arrives. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about what you knew, and if you've been working on it for 15 years, I'm sure it changed a lot. But what did you know initially that you wanted to do when you started this book? Like, did you sort of know who Cole would be when you started?
No, I definitely didn't. I wish I'd known more from the beginning because I might have been able to finish it more quickly. But I knew what Lydia and Lucas were going to kind of end up believing about him. Lucas always really believes that Cole is kind of the reincarnation of their dead brother, their dead triplet, really, who died in infancy. So I knew, I always knew that the stranger would come to town, that they would believe that he was connected to their family in this hard-to-believe way. I didn't know if he was or not for years while I was writing it. I didn't know if it was a supernatural book or not, and I didn't know. The one thing I knew was that he seemed dangerous.
Right.
I didn't even know if he really was dangerous, but I knew he seemed dangerous.
Right.
I knew that he felt like a threat to me, you know, and to Lydia. And I had to write and write to sort of get to the answers about why and if he really was.
Yeah.
So that evolved a lot.
Yeah, and I think that I started to, I mean, I kind of questioned from the very start his ability to ride this fantasy of Lucas's or this idea of Lucas's and not necessarily come out against it. But I also really started to suspect him because right from the start, he looks at everything with an expression of ownership, is something that she says early on. And I just thought that was this wonderful description of his character that immediately kind of put me, you know, a little bit suspicious of him. So I wonder if you can talk a little bit about building his character, which is a kind of a mysterious character with a lot of presence, which I would think would be hard to write.
Yeah, I mean, he was hard because he is, he has some contradictions.
Yeah.
In that he does feel kind of threatening, but also he's really charismatic. He's appealing. And he was appealing to me. I mean, he was a very fun character to write, and I felt drawn to him, you know, as a character, which I think I had to because Woody and Lucas feel so drawn to him. But it's a hard, you know, it's hard to get it right. Somebody who seems kind of threatening and scary, how do you also make them magnetic enough that they continue to exert control on the other characters, even while saying scary things or seeming threatening? So that was hard. I mean, that it took a kind of subtlety, you know, the things that made him seem a little dangerous had to be pretty subtle at first.
Right.
But then that was also a pitfall in writing because I kept it so subtle for so long that it, you know, things weren't ramping up. The danger wasn't getting any worse. It was staying in this realm of subtlety for a long time, I think. And that kept the book from feeling, from moving forward. It kept the narrative tension low, so it kept there from being a sense of urgency. It was really hard for me to escalate that the feeling of threat or danger with Cole, in part because I mean I think I'm lucky and haven't experienced a lot of danger of that kind, for sure, you know, so I didn't even really know how to make him more threatening or more scary. But also, you know, you get to like your characters, you want them to have a nice time. You don't want to put them in any uncomfortable or scary situation. So it was like an act of will to make things escalate for those poor characters.
Yeah, and I know exactly what you mean, because I find myself sometimes avoiding writing scenes of conflict, and it's like, it's okay. Yeah. This isn't a conflict actually in your life. This is just what the book needs to do now.
Right, exactly. And of course, like, fiction has to have conflict, and you know that. And that's the kind of fiction that is pleasurable to read. It has to exist. But when you're writing it, you get to know your characters. You want to protect them.
Right, right. Now, one thing that I think is really important to point out is that we particularly want to protect Lucas, who has some pretty serious anxiety issues. Do you mind if I just read a little quote from, it's like probably a short paragraph? Okay.
Yeah.
So this is Lydia's perspective. Imagine you had a brother like mine. I'm excerpting it. A brother who liked imaginary people best, who was always longing for some impossible happiness. A brother who suddenly grasped onto something, someone, with ease and joy, the way he was with Cole, laughing and talking. I'd never seen this before, not with anyone, not in all these years. So this is a person who basically lives in seclusion because he's sort of freaked out by people. He'll go to his job and come back home and sometimes go for walks, but he really avoids interacting with other people. So that was this wonderful character detail, and we worry about him. We want him to be okay. So he's particularly, maybe to me as a reader, he seemed particularly at risk with this stranger coming to town.
Yeah, for sure. I think that's true. And so, like, hungry to believe something.
Right.
To believe about Cole that he was, you know, their brother.
Yeah.
He was just so desperate to believe it, that he was vulnerable to the belief and to the man himself. So, yeah.
And I loved this little detail that she can tell what kind of day Lucas is having by what music he's listening to. If it's a Leonard Cohen day, it's probably going to be okay. If it's a Nina Simone day, they're in a lot of trouble.
Right. Yeah.
That was cool.
Yeah, that's true.
So this is going to be a hard question to ask, and because I really don't want to give anything away, but I feel like one thing you're really good at is bringing in an element that seems to be about one thing, and that's why it's brought into the plot, but eventually it turns out to be about something else. Is that enough of a teaser that we can talk about it?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I have an idea of what you're talking about. Yeah. Okay, well, here's an interesting thing. I mean, there is... Okay, so how can I talk about this without giving anything away?
We could come up with a hypothetical plotline.
there was definitely sort of a major question in the novel, right, that I was like... I was pretty far into writing it, and I was still asking myself, who is Cole?
Right.
You know, who is he really? I mean, it took me a long time to figure out the answer to that question. And so one of the things that happened was that I said, okay, maybe I've written the answer and I just don't know it.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
Maybe the answer is already in the book. And so, you know, going back and kind of looking at the things that have been mentioned more than once, especially things that don't necessarily, you know, that seem to have a little special emphasis placed on them, but it's unclear why, or, you know, things that recur that have a certain kind of brightness or vividness around the descriptions of them, or, you know, things like that. Or, you know, so I went back and looked, but I also talked it over with my friend Anne Cardinal from, who's also at the college. You know Anne, and she's a novelist. So she and I were writing her book kind of in parallel and really supporting each other through. And I think that that in the end, you know, when I would talk it over with her, it would be like, she had read the draft, you know, so we could look back through together. I was like, who is he? And I think in the end, she was like, what if? She helped me come up with like at least one answer to that, because it's a more complicated, you know, there's not just one answer, there are a few answers. But yeah, that's a trick to sort of saying, well, maybe I already know the answer. Maybe it's in the text already. And I've tried that with short stories, and it kind of interestingly works. You can go through and make a list of sort of the, and maybe you call them motifs, but I think that's not quite right, because it's more just the sort of objects that seem to be placed, or the things that seem to be placed throughout that have special meaning, and say the answer is in here somewhere. I just have to find it.
Right. And I think that would work particularly well with your prose, which is very vibrant. You have a lot of wonderful detail. I think that as you're working, you're including things because you want us to see what you see. And so you're really working to describe things well. You know, I think that somebody, and this isn't a criticism of how other people work, because I know that there are some writers, I know Ann Patchett, for example, she organizes everything ahead of time. She outlines, she knows exactly what's going to happen before she puts a pen to the page. And she's a beautiful writer.
Really? That's amazing. Yeah.
She's really,
wow.
But I think somebody who works like you work, it's lovely that you were able to go back and find something that was organic to the piece already, that you hadn't stuck in there for the value of what it would bring later. I mean, that's kind of cool.
Yeah, that is cool. Although I love Ann Patchett.
Me too.
And I mean, that's just interesting that you say that, because her, you know, when I was thinking about, when I was revising this book and thinking so much about narrative tension, and even just when I was like thinking about the kind of writer I want to be and the kind of novels that I want to write, I think about her a lot, because she's such, her storytelling is so beautiful and so satisfying. And, you know, the characters are wonderful and the sentence level writing is wonderful, but the plot lines feel to me so satisfying. So, you know, well, even just thinking about sort of like the John Gardner quote about two different kinds of plot lines. I mean, I actually think there are more, you know, plot lines than just those two, but I feel like she is definitely, Ann Patchett taps into some sort of storylines that feel so primal or something. I don't, you know, what's the word? Archetypal, maybe, that they're deeply satisfying. Yeah. So that's just interesting to think about her planning it out in such detail. I love that. I would love to try that with my second novel. Just so I'm maybe more in control of it than it is in control of me.
Yes.
Try that, you know. But I also know, so the other thing I think about a lot is George Saunders, who was my teacher in grad school. And we, you know, I mean, I still think about things he said to me often, but one of the things that I remember so clearly was him saying that sometimes you can make a little decision for the story that serves the story, It's just the tiniest little brushstroke, he said. You know, just like a little brushstroke. You don't have to redo the entire, what the entire thing looks like. Just one little move. So I think the example he gave with that was in his story, Com-Com, which is one of my favorites. Mm-hmm. There's the main character telling the story, and then he has a mean boss in it, and George said he just got, he's like, another mean boss. What am I doing? Just a mean boss. That character too, you know, cartoonish or something. He was unhappy, and he felt like maybe he was unkind to his character by just making him just mean, and he wanted to just give him something, just the tiniest little thing, just a little brush joke to change the way we read that character. And so we gave him a dying wife.
Okay.
And so it was just, you know, a line or two here and there. I mean, it was the tiniest little thing, and yet it changed the entire way we perceive it. Mm-hmm. So I think about that a lot, that, and I guess all that is saying is that there's a way to maybe be strategic, but I think for me, it might need to come kind of halfway through the writing process, if that makes sense. So maybe I wouldn't plan it all out ahead of time.
Right.
But I don't want to write for 15 years before I plan,
right.
You know, but maybe there's a sort of let yourself tap into whatever images, you know, are there in the story. Let yourself sort of explore the world a little without too much strategy. But then at some point, kind of get into that Ann Patchett brain where you are planning it out, and then apply the little brush strokes to help it work.
Right, right. Now, in those 15 years, did you ever at a certain point feel like you were finished and then discover that you weren't?
Oh, yes.
Yes. Yes.
I mean, I finished several drafts. I finished a draft, you know, early on. So I say it took me 15 years, but I think it only took 2 years to actually write a draft.
Okay.
But I finished it and knew it wasn't any good. I knew. I'm not hard on myself as a writer. So it wasn't like that. I mean, I knew. I was in grad school getting my MFA at Syracuse, I think, when I finished it. And I knew. And then, you know, but I thought, okay, that's fine. I know how to revise and rewrite. So I worked and worked on it. But then I got an agent, you know, years later, and I worked on revising it with her. She actually, when I got my agent, she said, she reached out to me and said, you know, do you have a manuscript? And
she saw a story or something?
She saw, yeah, I had an essay in Tin House.
Oh, great.
And I knew that, you know, I just knew that that was sort of, that felt like big to me. That felt like a sort of high profile enough publication.
Yeah.
And I thought, like, some agent is going to see this. Like, and so I wrote in my bio, you know, Micaiah lives in Vermont, where, you know, I just had my first baby. So I think it's something like, I just had my first baby, where she just had her first baby and is working on her first novel. I was like, I just want to put that out there. So if the right person sees it, they'll know that I'm working on this novel. And it worked just that way. She saw it. But when she read it, she said, okay, I want to work with you on it. I love it, but it needs a lot of work. And I'm willing to do that work with you, you know, but are you? Which, of course, I was. I loved that idea. So we worked on it for a couple of years together, and we thought it was finished. So she sent it out widely to publishers, and no one bought it.
Okay.
And so that was sort of a devastating moment where I was like, I thought it was finished. She thought it was finished. And it didn't sell. And so then that felt like a real crossroads where we had to sort of figure out where to go. But we had gotten some pretty positive and consistent feedback from some of the editors. A few had invited us to resubmit if I did a revision. And the feedback, you know, was consistent enough that we could sort of figure out what was going on, what we needed to do. And it took another couple years to do it. And that was, it was hard because I felt, and you know, a lot of the feedback had to do with narrative tension at that point.
Okay.
And it was so elusive for me, just so hard to get it right. It just felt like this impossible task. But so we worked on it together for another 2 or maybe even 2.5 years and then got it and sent it out again. And that's when it sold.
Wow.
So,
yeah. And so you're still working with the same agent. So that all worked out.
Yeah. Yes. She's great. I mean, I feel like, so grateful, right? She worked on this with me for 4.5 years.
Wow, before. That's fantastic. Oh, can I ask what her name is?
Yeah, she's Jenny Ferrari Adler at Union Literary.
Yeah.
And, you know, because the way agents work, I mean, I just kept thinking, she is not getting paid for this, right. You know, from my books. Like, this is, she believes in this. She's willing to take this risk to invest this time with me. I mean, she did line edits at various points. She had, you know, hour-long conversations to sort of talk through changes we could make.
Wow.
I feel really grateful. Yeah. That, you know, super amazing.
That's wonderful. Let's see. I want to just talk a little bit more about Goodnight Stranger. One thing that I thought was so wonderful was the way that you create these sort of themes of loneliness and aloneness, which are not the same thing in the book or in life. And also the way the island works to kind of create both a haven and an isolating factor for the characters. So it's like these things are all sort of working in tandem in a really beautiful way. And I wondered if you could talk at all about working on that.
Yeah. Well, I think that some of that is, those are just some of my kind of preoccupations.
Right.
You know, loneliness and loneliness is something I think about a lot. It's like been an interesting force in my life, you know, in an interesting way, you know.
Right.
And then I think the island setting, you know, so I grew up in Cape Cod. This book takes place on Wolf Island, which is a fictional island, but it's placed right next to Cape Cod. So the island doesn't really exist, but all of the sensory experience of the island is really real for me.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I moved to the Cape when I was 13. I went to high school there. And I just, you know, felt home. I felt like I was home when I got there in a really interesting way. I don't know if it was the age I was or if I just really have a kind of chemistry with that place. I mean, I think you would probably, you know the Cape, so you would say maybe everybody has great chemistry with that place. It's so beautiful. But I just, you know, 13 years old, moving there, we settled there. I'd moved around a lot as a kid before that. And then the Cape was sort of like home, like my mom is still there, you know, didn't leave. So it just was a really, so those, that sensory experience, those smells, those colors, you know, those tastes and sensations really became sort of deeply attached to whatever, you know, feelings you're processing as sort of a teenager, high school, going off to college, all of those things. You know, I think that was like the palette and the soundtrack that I attached to all those feelings. So it made sense to me that when I wrote this novel, which is in some ways about a kind of young person's struggle, like you said, with sort of loving their home and really resenting their home, that would be the setting for it. It just had to be for me, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I loved too the description of the tourists and the way that they want sunshine and they want what they think they deserve from a vacation.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when they arrive and it's raining, they just walk around grumpy in their raincoats.
Yeah, that's so true though, isn't it?
It is totally true. But then the other thing that had occurred to me that you've experienced firsthand from all different angles is that kind of towny tourist and kind of interloper situation. So you've been, I'll say, a townie, if that's not an offensive term, where you've lived in the island. You've also probably been a tourist yourself in places, but then you've also worked for a college. So you know, see the students coming in, for example, to Montpelier, and that's like another kind of dynamic with students coming in, and there are locals who kind of sometimes, I don't know about at Vermont College, but certainly at UVM, there's resentment when the students come in and it's like, oh my God.
Yeah. right. Yeah. Yeah, that's true. I've seen that. But also I've, you know, because I moved to the Cape when I was 13 and loved it and felt home, felt that I was home, but all the other kids had grown up there from the time they were little. They all really knew each other. And, you know, so I also had that aspect of it where I sort of felt like an outsider, even though in my heart I felt like an insider, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I feel that way about Vermont, and I was like 17 when I got here. So, you know, you'll never be accepted until you're like fourth generation. So,
Yeah, right. Exactly. I was born in Vermont, but didn't grow up here, you know, moved around a lot, but was born here. But somebody once said to me, just because a kitten's born in the oven doesn't make it a biscuit.
Okay.
So that's how Vermonters feel. You can't even be born here. Being born here doesn't even make you a Vermonter.
That's funny. Let's see. You used this great analogy to wildlife when you would enter into intense moments in the book. And I just loved this. You know, you kind of make Cole very wolf-like and almost very werewolf-like at certain moments. And then there's this great moment where Lydia says, "My heart was a frenzy of wings and feathers, too heavy but trying to fly." Just stunning prose. And also, I just kind of loved these analogies.
Thank you. I love that. Thank you for pointing that out. I think that's one of those things that I didn't know was happening. When you just said that you make these analogies to wildlife, I was like, what could she mean? I didn't even know.
Did she read the right book?
But I'm like, oh, yes, I see now.
No, and that was in the same scene. So it was wonderful. There was just this incredible sort of parallel scene going on visually if you kind of took the metaphors and carried them to the next level. So that was kind of cool. Micaiah, I was going to ask you if you've read anything lately that you would recommend to listeners, you know, most of whom are readers. So,
yeah, I just finished a book that I am crazy about. I'm so excited that you asked so I can talk about it.
Okay.
It's The Changeling by Victor Lavalle. Okay. Have you read that one?
No.
It's pretty new. I mean, I think it just came out in the last, you know, year or two.
Okay.
And I think people might call it a horror book, but it does so, you know, I think it's hard to categorize, you know, it does so many things. It defies being sort of labeled one genre or another. But it does this thing that I really love in books where the world that he describes is very real. It's New York City. It's a marriage, you know, with all of the things that happen in a young marriage. It's totally realistic. And then, you know, the rules are our rules of our world. It's not like fantasy or science fiction. It's our world. And then things happen that wouldn't happen in our real world. You know, then it's just a world that's like ours, but that allows for, you know, monsters and a sort of, and magic and a fairy tale logic. I don't know how to say anymore. I mean, it is about a changeling, right? Okay. It's like an actual changeling story. And it refers a lot to the Murray Sendak story Outside Over There.
Oh, yeah.
It's sort of based on that, but it is just a delight. It just thrilled me. I loved it so much.
Okay. That's great.
So that I recommend. I'm just starting to read the Jamal Brinkley book of short stories. It's a Grey Wolf book that was a finalist for the National Book Award.
Okay.
This past year, it's called A Lucky Man, I think. And it's stunning. If you like, you know, short stories, the first story in that collection just blaze me. I love it.
Okay.
It's so good. I've been reading so much lately. I run the Vermont Book Award.
Yes.
And so I have my whole stack of Vermont Book Award books kind of ready to, and I've been sort of starting to dip into them, and I'm really excited to read all of those finalists. There are 10 of them, so I won't list them all, but,
Yeah, I had Tony Whedon on the show. I had Tony Whedon on the show recently.
Oh,
yeah. He's one of your finalists this year.
Yeah, he is.
Yeah.
Yep. Drunk in the Woods.
Right. I'm trying to think who your other finalists are, but I'm not going to make you list them all. I did list them on the show when you made the announcement. So
yeah, right. We'll be one really exciting book. There's a graphic novel.
Oh right.
It's stunning. It's called Berlin by Jason Lutz, and it's very exciting. And then Rebecca Mackay, who lives in Vermont and in Chicago, but her book Great Believers is on that list. She's gotten a lot of attention for that.
Right. Right. All right. And then now you mentioned something about when you write your second novel, but have you started something new, or are you working on stories, or what are you working on these days?
Yeah, I started the new novel, the new project. I mean, I think I'm, 12,000 words in, so it's really just the beginning.
Okay.
But as soon as my kids are back in school in September and my book tour is over, I'm going to just hunker down and write that thing so fast.
That's
my intention. Yeah. So I've been working on a lot of little essays short essays these past few months, just to get things out there as we're promoting this book. So that's been really fun. I love writing these essays. And I'm always working on short fiction, but I am excited to dive into the big new project.
That's
a big
great
novel.
Do you know where your essays are going to show up, or have they yet?
Yeah, most of them have already come out. So I had one, when you asked about loneliness, I have one essay about loneliness.
Oh, wow.
In Salon that came out maybe 3 weeks ago.
Oh, okay.
I had a Modern Love column in the New York Times.
Oh, yes, I saw that. That was beautiful.
So there's that one. I did an essay about my deep love of Shirley Jackson and my panic disorder, which also shows up in Goodnight Stranger. There's, Lydia has some panic.
Right.
But I wrote an essay about panic and Shirley Jackson for Lit Hub. And I have an essay that I think is going to run in Poets and Writers this winter.
Oh, cool.
That I'm really excited about. It's meaningful. As somebody who teaches in an MFA program, it's kind of a meaningful essay for me, just when I think about my students. So I'm really excited about that one.
Oh, that's great. Okay, wonderful. Yeah, and I was going to ask about your teaching. So how long have you been teaching at Vermont College?
Well, I started working at Vermont College more than 10 years ago, but I was just editing Hunger Mountain. That was my in. Yeah. I was the editor of Hunger Mountain for 9 years.
Wow.
But then at some point I sort of also was directing the new MFA in Writing and Publishing program. I did that for 3 years,
right?
Yeah, when we were kind of starting up the program, Trini Dalton was really started the program, and then I came on within a year to work with her. And now I'm, I left the sort of administrative piece because I wanted to write more. It's just so consuming, to administer a program. So I'm still teaching in that program just a little bit. So I've been sort of with that program for, this will be my fifth year with the MFA in Writing and Publishing.
Okay, great.
Which is great. I mean, I love our students are amazing. I mean, that VCFA students are fantastic.
Yeah,
and I feel like there's something, most of the programs at the college are low residency. And our program, the MFA in Writing and Publishing, is the first traditional kind of residential program. Students move to Vermont for 2 years. And they just are so, they form such a bond. It's so beautiful to watch them support each other. And I love it. I love working with them.
Now, do they live on campus, or they live in apartments mostly?
Some of them live on campus. It's been about half and half. We have a sort of dorm that we offer to them. And we weren't sure if, as grad students, they would want to. But it's been really kind of amazing to see them in the dorm. They cook meals together. It's really beautiful. I mean, I think they, it's also a dorm, and I mean, they're beautiful. The dorm is really beautiful, like surprisingly, wood floors, and I actually love it. And I love the, I would love to live with a bunch of other writers in the dorm someday. That sounds incredible to me. I feel
that.
Like they're really good sports, and they just throw themselves into it. And they know that, once they have their MFA, they can go get their apartments. And
right.
So about half, usually half live off campus, half live on.
I do. I did go to Vermont College, but I went to the low residency writing program, and I do miss that camaraderie from those residencies. It was amazing.
Yeah, right? When you're just together talking, writing all the time.
Yeah. Right. Well, I do have one last question for you, Micaiah. I always like to finish up by asking my guests for advice for writers. And in your case, and it's interesting that you were describing The Changeling as you were, as sort of genre-defying. And my advice question is, if you have any advice about writing literary suspense, I feel like readers are really sort of starving for literary suspense, and yet so many suspense writers do rely on genre formula. And your book, I think, doesn't fit any sort of formula. And so I wonder if you have thoughts on this.
Yeah. Well, I definitely didn't know that I was writing literary suspense when I was writing it. So that helped. All I knew was that I wanted to write something that made readers want to turn pages. Mm-hmm. I knew that I wanted my readers to have that experience. I wanted their hearts to beat fast while they were reading it.
Right.
So that kind of is a, I mean, that describes a literary thriller, but I didn't know that that's what I was doing. but, you know, the sort of getting that sense of urgency is really intense. And so and in a way you want that in any novel that you're writing. You want to sort of play with that sense of urgency, whether it's literary suspense or not, but you need it in literary suspense. And I had a really late in the game revelation about it. I told you that I worked for years trying to get the narrative tension right.
Yes.
And we were very, my agent and I would have endless conversations. I would talk with my writing friends. We were very focused on plot. Mm-hmm. And just couldn't quite get there. And I finally sent a manuscript to my friend Dan Tordet, the novelist who wrote Boomer One is his new book, and The Last Light of Poxville West is his last book.
Okay.
You know, and I was like, Dan, I need your help. Will you read it and tell me how I can fix the plot to fix the narrative tension? And he read it and got back to me and said, the plot is not the problem. The plot is fine. It's the character. She doesn't have enough agency. Things are just happening to her.
Oh, yeah.
And if you went through and sort of located all the kind of important plot points where things change or turn or information is revealed and made it so that Lydia was making those things happen through her actions, it would have, you know, more of a sense of urgency. And I did it and it worked.
Yeah.
It was amazing. So that focus on a character making the plot unfold because of their actions is my advice.
And that would have been really hard too, because Lydia has a certain amount of fear of leaving the island. And so for her to have agency, in a way, yeah. Actually, though, it works really well, because we know as we're reading that it's hard for her, but she's doing it. So that's cool.
Yeah. And then, I mean, so for instance, really early on in the book, you know, she sees the stranger. He's so handsome and charismatic. And she basically like goes to the bar and sort of tries to seduce him, right?
Right.
And like invites him home with her. And in all of the early drafts, leading up to that final draft, he tried to seduce her and she resisted. And then I said, okay, well, if I'm making plot things happen because of her actions, then she has to be the one to seduce him. And it was so much fun. That scene ended up being super fun to write. And then what happens is everything that unfolds after that point with a stranger in their lives, she's kind of responsible for
yes.
that, you know, in some way, because she is the one who brings him into their home.
Right, as he points out to her again and again. Yeah.
Yeah. So it really made it much more interesting and heightened the tension just to have her be active in that way.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. All right. Well, I want to just mention again, the name of the book is Goodnight Stranger, a novel by Micaiah Bay-Galt, published by Park Row Books. Micaiah, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you. This was really a wonderful conversation.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3 WBTV.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was an interview with Vermont author Micaiah Bay-Galt. You can learn more about her work at MikayaBayGalt.com. This week's Write the Book prompt is to try your hand at the exercise that brought Micaiah to find the first line of Goodnight Stranger, a trick that was suggested to her by former Write the Book guest, Juliana Baggett. Try summing up your novel in the first sentence and see what happens. When she was the editor of the journal Hunger Mountain, for one issue, Micaiah Baygalt set the authors this task, which comes from a famous Ray Bradbury exercise for generating ideas. Jot lists, without thinking too hard, of the things that represent the writer's deepest interests, preoccupations, desires, fears, obsessions. This original exercise can be found in Bradbury's essay Run Fast, Stand Still, or The Thing at the Top of the Stairs, or New Ghosts from Old Minds. In his book Zen in the Art of Writing, Essays on Creativity. So that can be a second prompt this week. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. I'd love your feedback about the show. Let me know if you'd like me to interview certain authors or if you have events to announce. Be sure to tell your friends about Write the Book and about the podcast site, writethebook.podbean.com. We're also on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, all the podcast sites. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you like the show, please do rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and talk about it. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3 WBTV.org. Have a great week.